We all have the same amount of time every day. It's just how are we going to invest it? And I like to say to parents, think in terms of what is the time that my kid is seeing on the screen? What is it teaching them? What do they come away with, you know, and how is it impacting them? Because it is impacting them.
Dr. Gary Chapman joins us today on Focus on the Family, along with Arlene Pellicane. I'm John Fuller, and your host is Focus on the Family President, Jim Daly.
I don't know about you, John, but screen time is really the battle. I think most parents, if not all parents, face this problem. But
personally and as a parent. Yes.
Well, maybe as adults, too. I mean, that's one of the difficulties. It kind of has consumed our life, you know. Having all the information in the world at our fingertips keeps us busy asking it things. Gene and I do that. Last night we were going to bed, and we talked about where the game of chess was created. And she starts getting out of bed, and she's going to her phone. What are you doing? Well, I'm going to check out where chess came from, which, you know, it's that kind of thing. You have all that information. Yeah. And, of course, kids, younger people use it for social media, for gaming, et cetera. It's a big issue. Today we are going to have, I think, one of those monumental discussions about screen time by two great guests.
Yeah, we've got, as I said, Dr. Gary Chapman and Arlene Pellicane. You know Dr. Chapman from his 5 Love Languages books. They are bestsellers in so many different variations. And Arlene is an author and speaker, as well as mom to 3 kids. They have a great book that they've written together called Screen Kids, 5 Skills Every Child Needs in a Tech-Driven World.
Dr. Chapman and Arlene, welcome back to Focus. It's always good to have you here.
Super fun to be here.
Yes, thank you. Always glad to be back.
Arlene, let's start with you. You speak and write about technology. Dr. Chapman, you counsel parents who are struggling with their kids. What are you hearing when you're interacting with those parents about, specifically about screen time?
Yeah, I hear things like, where did my child go? You know, like when we started and we went, okay, it's the pandemic and my child wants, is saying, hey, I need social media now to connect with my friends. And of course, the parents are thinking, well, this is the way people are communicating. They're online. So they give their 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old this social media. And then 6 months later, they're saying, what happened? Like, why are they believing these things? Why are they in their room so much? Why? So a lot of that. And then I think if families, if you're struggling before the pandemic with, man, we're playing too many video games, or I don't like what my kid is watching, now, after the pandemic, you know, there's one statistic I read that May 2019 compared to May 2020, the screen time had jumped 50% for kids.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're struggling then, man, and it's because you have this mixture of online school, which is, hey, that's legitimate and you're supposed to be doing that. But then now you have online school plus all the entertainment, and all the entertainment is happening right next to the child, you know, while they're doing online school. You know, there's all sorts of things, tabs open and different things. So this is really a huge challenge for families.
Arlene, you speak about ABCD study and some of the early findings in that. What is the ABCD study?
Right. It's adolescent brain cognitive development, and they are following over 10,000 kids over a 10-year period. And they're already finding that there's a link between screen time and a lot of different changes in the brain. And it's interesting because sometimes we as parents, we wait for the research. You know, we want to see the research and then, okay, we'll make our decision. But truly, that research happens in your own home of what you see in your child and how you see them changing. So I just encourage you, if you see things that you're wondering about, you don't have to wait till scientists come out. But here's what they found in terms of things that they see: a thinning of the cortex, and it's this part of the brain that usually starts thinning when kids, you know, people are in their 60s. And so here they're seeing it already getting thin in children when they are on screens too much. But what they found was when kids met 3 markers, they were much healthier. So this is kind of, I think, a hopeful thing that we can shoot for instead of concentrating maybe on what we're limiting, which is important, but concentrate what do we need to put in each day first. And they talk about 9 to 11 hours of sleep. You know, and that seems easy enough, but if you have a child, teenager, with a phone in the bedroom, and it's like an electronic baby, you know, it's like a digital baby, it's like 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, they're getting texts, they're taught, you know, they're not sleeping. So 9 to 11 hours of sleep, no more, and even, can you imagine during COVID, but 2 hours or less of recreational screen time. So that digital candy that's just for fun.
And that's what's so difficult.
2 hours or less, yeah. And then 60 minutes of physical activity. I mean, they're kids.
Yeah.
So if you kind of think to yourself, okay, my kid needs to move. They can have a little bit of digital candy, but not too much. And then we need to get a good night's sleep. If you can even just get those three things in order and really focus on those three things, you're going to see a difference in your health.
That's great. And those are good tips. You know, Gary, so often we're hearing about, you know, the entrapment of screen time and all that. Parents have always been concerned about what their kids are doing, I think forever. And, you know, whether it was watching too many movies or whatever it may have been before we had technology. So what is the allure? What are young people attracted to when it comes to technology? Why is it so addictive to them?
Well, I think there's several things, but I think one of them is that, you know, like in the gaming thing, and you get feedback, you know, you get rewarded, and you don't know when you're going to get it, and it just keeps you going.
Right.
I think the other thing is that it's just streaming all the time. It never stops. You know, when our kids came along, you know, this was many years ago, we just had television. Well, you can pretty easily say, here are five programs. You know,
right.
You can choose two of them and 30 minutes apiece, you know, each day. You can pretty well handle that. But with the screen, it's just constantly there. It doesn't have an end to it. And so I think kids just get caught up in it. And what we were just talking about, the whole thing is they don't learn social skills. And imagine what that's going to be like when they get to be an adult. I mean, you know, if a kid through all the high school time and all is playing games online, he's going to be doing that when he's 25 and married.
Right.
And it's not going to be well for the marriage, okay? I'm for marriages.
Right. No, absolutely. And we hear from people that are experiencing that,
yeah,
right now. I mean, a lot of women, young married couples, saying, I've got a real problem in my marriage, and my husband spends most of the free time after he gets home,
yeah,
gaming.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to continue today and next time to talk about what can be done to help, especially young people, teenagers in this area. But let's move for the parents. Let's move to the warning signs. When do we know, or when should we know, that this has become an addiction? What are those warning signs, and what should we be looking for?
If you see your child is really moody, irritable, like more than usual, if you see, wow, they're only happy, it seems like, when they're gaming or they're on social media or they're holding a device. If you see, like, oh, my child used to love to play the piano or used to love to play soccer or used to hang out with the friends in the backyard, and now all of a sudden they're like, nah, I'd rather just stay in my room. You know, so if you see this lack of interest in the activities that they like, you see that they are asking for more and more and more, right? And there are negative consequences. There's friction in the house around this. So you might have, you know, think of it like your child could be a casual, at risk, or addicted gamer. And here's how you know. If you're a casual gamer, you know, they pick up the game for 20 minutes, not a big deal. They leave, they don't play for several days, and then they pick it up. It's really not a big deal in their life. And you're like, awesome, right?
Right.
The at risk is, okay, they're supposed to play over the weekend, but every day they're asking, Mom, Dad, could I play, you know, just for half an hour? Mom, Dad, could I play for 15 minutes more? And then you're thinking, like, oh, they're getting kind of really interested in this. And then your addicted child, of course, is like, okay, we served dinner like 4 hours ago, and if you want it, it's in the microwave, you know, that you know they're checked out, you know. So you can kind of see where your child is, because some kids can play and be okay,
yeah,
but then other kids can't.
You know, Gary, especially in that area of psychology, is something, well, you both have studied, but in that regard, this was all promised to be a connection, to enhance people's connections with other people. The irony is, when you look at the research, people are lonelier, they're more separated, even though they have more access to social media and those things that are supposed to connect people. But it hasn't really worked out, has it?
I think social media is not very social.
Yeah.
The reality. And I think it's because it's really an unreal world. I mean, what people are putting on, like teenagers are putting on and posting, you know, are things. And so the kid looks at the other kid and says, oh, man, look at that. I didn't know he had a car already, you know. Well, I don't have a car, you know.
Right.
They're just seeing all this stuff and comparing themselves with each other. And consequently, you know, they feel like, well, they're better than I am, or they're, you know, got more of this or that or the other thing. And it's not building relationships.
Yeah, the lack of community.
Like, even think of what it's called. You have a follower. And my daughter, Noelle, she's a freshman in high school. So, you know, that's a ripe age to want social media and do all those things. So she's not allowed to have it because I write this book, Screen Kids, you know, so she's not allowed to have it. But she has told me, you know, Mom, I would rather have a real friend in real life sit next to me, look at me and say, you're loyal, you're a good friend. I'd much rather have that, Mom, than 100 followers that I barely know. And so kids know the difference, and they think they fall into that trap of, oh, if I have these followers, I'll be happy. But it's this image management that is way too much for a girl, like to think, like, I've got to manage my image, and how should I respond to that so that I'm popular, and how can I get more response? So it's all about response, following. It's not about true friendship. And those friends, you know, my son Ethan, he also doesn't have social media. He's a junior. But he was talking about that there was this Facebook study where he, some guy invited all of his followers, like 300 followers, to a party, and just one guy showed up. And he was just saying, like, you have this false sense of all these people in my life, and I'm really popular. But when it comes down to it, if you get sick, who's coming to visit you? You know, it's like nobody is coming to visit you.
Right. No.
So to help our kids understand, they need real life friends.
Let me ask both of you to share some ways that parents can model this. How do parents connect with their children in order to look like, feel like this is what a normal relationship is all about? What can we do?
Well, you know, Jim, I had a mother share this with me recently because I had encouraged in one of my meetings, why don't you ask your teenager, you know, I'm thinking about how I could be a better mother, and I'd like you to give me one idea of how I could be a better mother. And she said, I was shocked when my daughter said to me, well, Mom, I feel like I don't ever have your full attention. When I'm talking to you, you're always doing something. You've got the phone you're looking at. You've got the computer you're on. And I don't ever feel like I have your full attention. And her mother said, oh, well, I didn't realize that. You know, and we don't realize that.
Sure.
You know, so as adults, we have to think in terms of our own use of technology, because we may be setting for them an example, and they're just following our example when they turn in that direction.
Yeah.
But the kid wants to have a meaningful personal relationship with their parents, and that means undivided attention. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that and be messing with your phone.
You know, Gary, I think you were the one that suggested this a long time ago. In the marriage relationship, take some time. Like when you get home from work, both of you, one of you, whatever the situation is, and spend a little time together. And I'm parlaying that into your relationship with your children. It's, I think, one of the, you know, I'm hopeful I don't have many mistakes in my parenting. I'm sure there's more than I see. But one of the things I regret I didn't do, having two boys 2 years apart, I tended to do everything together with them. Hey, let's go have breakfast together. Let's go do this together. Because they're both boys, and it was easy to bundle that way, if I could say it. And I hear about other dads particularly who were able, because they had daughters and sons, you know, they separated their time.
Yeah.
And if I could redo one thing, that would be it, is to have that one-on-one time so we can look forward to it, spend time talking together, asking questions of each other. I would think that very marriage advice that you provide also applies to your kids.
Yeah, I really agree. Have a daily sit down and listen time.
Yeah. I mean,
tell me a couple of things that happened today and how did you respond to them?
Yeah.
Did you see anybody angry today? Did you have to apologize today? What went on today? You know, that kind of, well, I don't mean you have to be sitting down. You can be taking a walk together, but you're sharing those things. That's what builds relationships with children.
And it also models what human interaction is supposed to look like,
absolutely.
Right? Which is back to the very point.
Yeah,
have you done something like that?
Well, yeah, it's the idea of pivoting. So if you are looking at your device and a human being, you know, it could be a spouse, a child, you know, a stranger, but, you know, it's a human being comes to your airspace, that's common courtesy to look away from your device, look at them in the eye, and have some kind of like, hey, how are you doing? And what we're seeing is in families, we're not pivoting from our devices. We're, you know, think about if you are having a conversation, the qualitative difference. If you're looking at each other, that's a different feel than, let's say, you're both staring at devices, you're using the exact same words, but it feels very different. So be aware of your eyes today. Like, what are you looking at? When your child is there, are you looking at the phone, but you're saying, get your coat, it's cold. okay, we're going to leave in 5 minutes. Hey, go get your sister, you know, and you're not really looking at them. Your kids notice that. Now, if you do that once in a while, that's not a big deal.
Right. It's
but
a
if
pattern.
Day after day, moment after moment, every time your child refers to you, they see that your attention is on a device. They're going to get that message, as Dr. Chapman has said so well. That device is more important than me. And that's, you know, there's so many kids. We think it's the kids that have the problem, but there's so many kids who are like, if my mom or dad would just stop, check an email, and I would feel more loved.
I think taking an assessment of that is really good, because I've tried to do that. And I know of times when I'm talking with one of my boys and I get a ping, and they're still talking to me, and I'm like eyeing, okay, who's that from? What person is it important? It does communicate what's in front, and what's in my hand is more important than the child in front of me.
And you can have this conversation with your kids and kind of bust each other on it. That's kind of fun, because Lucy, my daughter, she's 11 now. It's harder with online school for us because they're 100% at home. So I'm working. I'm not thinking like every time you walk in the room, I have to pivot, you know, to look at you. But Lucy will say to me, Mom, pivot, you know, and I'll have to pivot away from my desk and say, hey, Lucy, what's going on?
It's a good word.
So you kind of can remind each other, parents to children and children to parents. Give yourself that freedom.
Let me poke the sensitive area for parents, because you point to a study that said that 70% of children that are online have been exposed to pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something Focus on the Family has fought for years, and yet it doesn't feel like we're gaining ground. In fact, it feels like we're losing, especially with the pervasive nature of technology today. You almost have to inoculate your children, talk about when this pops up, here's what you need to do. But speak to that. I mean, it's almost like the analogy that pops in my head is like a fishing net. It used to be a fishing pole's out there trying to get your kid. Now it's these big drag nets that are just scooping our kids up and introducing them to things that are wholly inappropriate.
And this is one of the top reasons why my 16-year-old son does not have a phone, because it's kind of that idea of delaying that device as much as possible, because you know that once that device is accessible to your child, and once your child is introduced to all these things, I mean, it's natural to be curious and to want to do these things, but then it becomes so evil and so distorted and so shameful, and it's such a trap for kids and for adults. And so, one, I would say delay the device as much as possible, because you think you're helping your child be safe because you give them a phone so they can contact you, but you're also giving them a way to get a hold of a really, a lot of bad stuff.
And what's so, you know, again, what's so difficult in the parenting role is it's going to be different for your 11, 12, 13-year-old compared to your 17, 18-year-old. I mean, I have an 18-year-old senior still at home.
Yeah.
So you're trying to equip them to think smartly.
Also, I think it's really important that if it comes up, that you don't panic about it, that you listen, and that it's something okay to talk about, and that sex is something that you're talking about with kids at a very young age now. And, you know, not long conversations. When I talk to my son about, you know, hey, all those YouTube videos, you know, you can really get into trouble. He doesn't want to talk to me about that for 10 minutes. But, you know, a short conversation, and make those conversations part of regular life, because it is something that your kids are going to have to deal with and wrestle with.
Gary, what does a screen smart and a screen safe home look like?
You know, I think there are a number of things, Jim. One is there ought to be times and spaces in the house where we don't have devices. And one of those, I think, is the mealtime.
Yeah.
You know, we don't even have our phones with us, and we're not responding if we hear them in the other room, and the TV is not on. The mealtime is the time for us to talk to each other. And it can be one of the most meaningful things for kids. In fact, our kids look back and tell us, that's one of the best memories they have of childhood, is the talking around the table, you know. And then also, the devices would not be in their bedrooms. They ought to be collected somewhere by parents, and they're not in the bedroom. In the bedroom, you can read a book if you like before you go to sleep. Read as long as you want to before you go to sleep, because we want them to learn to read, because that's a very positive thing in terms of mental development and so forth. So I think having those spaces where we don't have screens and where we don't answer them if we hear them in the distance is one thing. I think another thing is that we communicate to them some of the things that they're going to encounter perhaps on there, like the bullying thing, for example, that you may get some things that are said to you that are going to be hurtful, and I want you to come and tell me about them. Yeah. When you see those, come and tell me about them. Let's talk about them, because it can be devastating to a child when they get those kind of comments. And if they don't share them with their parent and get some affirmation from the parent, they can get sucked into that, you know, very, very much.
Yes. The other observation that we have is that I think the CDC released a report not long ago that 14 to 24-year-olds, that 25% of those people have had suicidal ideation, meaning they've thought about killing themselves. That's 25%. It's several million people that represents. How much have they been able to determine how influential screen time is in that sense of anxiety and depression?
I think it is a huge factor, because if a child growing up feels the security and the closeness of their family, if they are successful in school, you know, that they feel like they can do it, they're going to be okay. You know, they're going to feel okay. So something's missing. Something's not happening. And I think what you're seeing is from birth to 10, instead of kids being attached to their parents, they get attached to that iPad that's entertaining.
Wow.
And amusing.
That's convicting.
And then as parents, we're busy, so we think, well, at least they're safe and, you know, they're okay and they're just sitting right here. So we're physically present with our kids, but we are emotionally distant. Mm. And I think as you grow up and that becomes very common, so you think, well, this is just the way it is. And then you have all these kids who don't have that right basis for judging. How is my life meaningful? Am I safe? Am I one? I mean, I've had kids that look so good on the outside, you know, say, I've been thinking about killing myself. I think, where does this come from?
Yeah, it's almost epidemic, actually. And so we need to start pointing out those things that are at least, contributing to these thoughts and ideas. Gary, how can we ensure the emotional health and well-being of our children? I mean, that's a bold question right at the end here, but what are those things we should be doing?
Well, obviously, Jim, you'd expect me to say, and I would say, speak their love language.
That's right.
Right. No, that's perfect. You're the man. You're the love language man.
Hug your child,
but
not the iPad.
What about that 13-year-old says, yeah, Dad, my love language is gaming.
Yeah,
or a phone.
And
yeah.
You say, let's see. I don't see that in the five.
Yeah, that's not the five, right?
Now, I do think the child's deepest emotional need is the need to feel loved by the parents.
Yeah.
And if that child genuinely feels loved by the parent, they're first of all going to be more open to your instruction, and they're going to be less rebellious because they feel secure in your love.
Yeah.
So learning a child's primary love language, giving heavy doses of that, and then sprinkling in the other four languages, because we want the child to learn how to receive and give love in all five languages. This is the healthiest adult.
Hit those five so the parents know them.
Yeah, one of them is words of affirmation, you know, and that's not hard to do. And then there's gifts. And that can be difficult with teenagers, because they can say, that's my love language, and I want everything. But you say, I love you too much to give you everything. But gifts. And then there's quality time. We were talking about that earlier, and giving them your full attention. And then there's acts of service, doing things for them, helping them fix a bicycle chain or mending a doll dress or anything, cooking a meal and all of that. And then physical touch, affirming physical touch.
Yeah.
And each child, one of those is more important than the others. I call it their primary language. So you give heavy doses of that. And then you speak the others. If that child feels loved, they're going to be more open to whatever guidelines and rules that you set up regarding technology.
And we're going to explore more of that connection next time, Gary. But I think at the end here, for that parent that gets frustrated because, you know, they're looking out for the best interest and safety of the child. And so they could be pretty demanding in what that child can and cannot do. And, of course, that child translates that as, I don't think you love me. I mean, I could hear that right now, right? So let's get into that next time and talk about how a parent does that balancing act, that high wire act between, I know what's right for you and I love you, but you can never do this again, because that's a very complicated parenting mess. Can we do that?
Yes.
Of course.
Okay.
Well, I love these kinds of programs, Jim, because they're so informative and helpful for all of us as parents. I always leave a conversation like this with some action items, and we're going to pause right there for today's episode of Focus on the Family and come back to more of the great discussion with Dr. Gary Chapman and Arlene Pellicane next time. I do hope you can join us for that. On behalf of Jim Daly and the entire team, thanks for joining us today for Focus on the Family. I'm John Fuller.
Well, that was so good. And that's exactly why Focus on the Family is here. We want to give you the tools you need to be an effective and loving parent, to raise the next generation so they can be strong, flourishing adults who stand for Christ. And we're here for you to help you do that, not just on the air with programs like this, but with reliable, practical help and resources. You know, real families in crisis reach out to Focus on the Family each and every day, and we're grateful. You can offer them tangible hope by partnering with us. Whether it's couples on the verge of divorce, parents who need biblical advice, or families who are simply struggling, you can offer them practical solutions through your support of Focus on the Family. Your gift today will share the healing and hope of Jesus Christ as you support our broadcasts, podcasts, counseling resources, online articles, life-changing events, etc., etc. You can add your support when you call us on 031-716-3300 or when you visit our website at safamily.co.za. And when you visit the website, you'll be able to listen to the program again or share the link with someone you think it'll help. You'll also find the excellent book by Arlene and Dr. Chapman that was spoken of today, Screen Kids, 5 Skills Every Child Needs in a Tech-Driven World. And have a look out for our upcoming tour of events happening in October with Dr. Steve Bass, an author and counselor with over 30 years of experience in counseling. He's going to be speaking to parents in a morning session called Radical Parenting, and he'll help couples in an evening event called Stronger, a 5-step guide to strengthening your marriage. You'll find all the information on dates and venues, and you can book your tickets on our website at safamily.co.za. Thanks for joining us today. For Focus on the Family Africa, I'm Graham Schnell, inviting you back next time when we'll once again help you and your family thrive in Christ.